Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from India is Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include Treading Softly on Sacred Ground, Counterinsurgency Operations on Sacred Space, The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, the Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And thank you for staying up, and we're very grateful for the time you can spend with us. Is there a divorce going on between the U.S. and Pakistan, and is the Obama administration wooing Pakistan's arch rival, India?
The U.S.-India rapprochement has been really ongoing since 2000 and before, so there's really nothing new. In the Indo-U.S. relationship, you recall in 2005, under the Bush administration, there was the U.S.-Indian civilian nuclear program. So, the U.S.-India relationship no longer keys off of that Pakistan relationship, but the U.S. it's impossible to understate the degree to which the United States government, across virtually all agencies dealing with Pakistan, is in fact utterly exhausted and fed up with Pakistan.
So, but the fact that the Defense Minister, Leon Panetta, had a press conference in New Delhi where he castigated the Pakistanis over safe havens, et cetera, first of all, what was he in India for? He was trying to get some agreement.
Like I said, the Indo-U.S. rapprochement, it's been ongoing since 2000 and before. So that's not where the news is. The U.S.-India relationship has been on a steady glide path. We've been, this has been perhaps the only success of President Bush's administration was that he was able to really recalibrate Indo-U.S. relationship. The real story is not what he did or did not say in India. The real story is about the degree to which virtually every single agency that handles Pakistan in the United States is really done with Pakistan. In the last several months, I can't tell you how many people have said to me from a variety of agencies representing DOD, as well as the State Department, that says, I don't think the Pakistanis realize how close we are to bombing them. And this is a sentiment that is continuously relayed. And so the India thing is not something that this is a sort of here shining. It's a distraction. The real issue is what's happening with the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. And what I think is kind of interesting is the Pakistanis keep banking on how important they are. But what they've kind of missed is that the Americans really have come to the conclusion that they don't need Pakistan like they thought they had. And so this kind of gives the Americans a lot more leverage. We're not bending over backwards to pay whatever exorbitant price to get the ground lines of control open. We're continuing to use drones and, in fact, expand drones, even though domestically they're very unpopular. The U.S. has basically said to Pakistan, in so many words, you're part of the problem. You're not part of the solution. And everything that Pakistan has done, literally over the last year and a half, has demonstrated Pakistan's commitment to be part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Well, I think the Secretary of Defense in India, and he was making jokes about how the U.S. kept the Pakistanis in the dark in the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. I imagine that didn't that sort of bridled the Pakistanis, but and of course he's critical about the Pakistanis working with the Haqqani network. That's not new in as much as...
But this is nothing new.
Exactly.
For crying out loud, Admiral Mullen,
right,
in one of his final swan songs last year, over a year ago, said that Haqqani was a veritable arm of the ISI. So I think it's easy to get spun up over what Panetta said, where he said it, but the real issue is these are things that have been said to the Pakistanis before. And the thing that's so frustrating is that it doesn't matter how you tell the Pakistanis this. They continue sleepwalking through this dream of their own importance. They have not gotten the memo that the United States government is sick and tired of their nonsense.
So,
and, if it takes Panetta saying that from New Delhi, so be it. But the Pakistanis are utterly resistant to this message.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer and a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She's talking to us from India. Now, things have changed, clearly. I mean, you mentioned the ground routes that supply all of the war material for NATO and the U.S. in...
They don't supply. That's the point. Yeah. That's the point that Pakistan has missed, is that we have found a way to work around them.
Right. Well, that's what I understand. And now the one big concern was that there's so much NATO material that has to be moved out of that country, heavy material, weaponry, et cetera, and that there was a concern that if the Pakistanis didn't open that up, that this material may be left behind, like all those rotting Russian tanks. Now, apparently a deal has been struck with the stands, right, to get all of that stuff out.
Well, I see the Russians have kind of resisted using the northern distribution route for lethal stuff, but the fact is, the combination of the northern distribution route and moving things through air, we've really kind of obviated the need for Pakistan. And, of course, the Pakistanis don't seem to get this. They keep howling, well, if you pay us some ridiculous sum of money, we'll open the GLOCs. The Americans are like,
well,
five, I don't think so.
It went up from, what, a couple of hundred per vehicle to 5,000? That was...
I mean, it's absurd. And so... You know, what is very interesting from my point of view, as somebody who's been watching this relationship now for a really long time, well over a decade, is that for the first time Americans are realizing that actually the Pakistanis need us more than we need them. They are an economic basket case. At some point, they're going to have to go back to the IMF. Now, that's when the United States is going to have a really interesting opportunity. Typically, the U.S. forces the IMF to go back and make some deal with the Pakistanis that everyone knows they're going to renege on. Increasingly, there are people, including me, who say, actually, we should let the Pakistanis fall flat on their face, because why should the IMF keep coming in, cutting these deals? Why should the American taxpayer keep subsidizing Pakistan's elite, because they don't want to tax themselves? And this has been the persistent row at the IMF. The Pakistanis don't want to expand their tax net. They don't leave aside the tax debate in the United States and how appalling it is. But in Pakistan, the parliamentarians who have themselves elected refuse to enact either an agricultural or an industrial tax, because most of their wealth and that of their patrons come from agricultural and industrial income. Can you imagine anything more absurd? So, you know, the United States, I think, is really coming to a position where it's deeply frustrated. It understands that what Pakistan wants for the region is injurious to our interests, that we don't need them as we previously did, and we have a lot more room, you know, just in the same way that the Pakistanis are renegotiating their relationship with us and on what terms, we're doing the same thing, and what we're really kind of concluding is that Pakistan is more, quite frankly, looking like an enemy than an ally. And this is something, you know, you and I, we've discussed this for years now, but finally multiple agencies, including the U.S. Congress, have really come to this conclusion independently.
So the idea that there may be some way to open up the supply routes through Pakistan into Afghanistan, which have been closed since 24 Indian Pakistani soldiers were killed on a border skirmish, which the Pakistanis are insisting on a U.S. apology. Obviously, in this political year, in a presidential election, with Mitt Romney already trying to define Obama's foreign policy as a foreign policy of apologizing, there's no way in the world that Obama is going to apologize, right? So. Is there any way that this apology thing?
I mean, this apology thing, I think people have taken this out of its context. First of all, every time some soldier, you know, looks crosswise at some Afghan, there is an apology. So this idea that the fact of the matter is the U.S. was predominantly at fault during that Salhala strike for a number of reasons. But whereas we will readily apologize to the Afghans for any number of trespasses and defenses, The issue with Salala is that Americans genuinely feel that the Pakistanis have been taking our money and supporting the Taliban, who have been killing our troops. Our troops aren't being killed by Al-Qaeda, they're being killed by the Taliban. And so even though there is a consensus within those who know about the Salal attack, that the U.S. and, you know, in NATO, but primarily the U.S. is at fault, there's a sense, have the Pakistanis apologized for the Haqqani network attacking the U.S. embassy, for the 1,500 or so American troops that have been killed by the Taliban? And so, in some sense, the anger on the U.S. side about Salalah and the refusal to apologize is cumulative, stemming from 10 years of Pakistani perfidy. The issue of the apology itself is quite frankly puerile. I mean, we apologize to the Afghans for any number of offenses that are not nearly as egregious as this. But the point is, no one wants to apologize to the Pakistanis because they have taken $22 billion from us to support the war on terror, when in fact they were indeed supporting the war on terror, primarily by supporting our enemies. And so the discussion about the apology or lack thereof will often get cast into this issue of Romney versus Obama. But to do that really does violence to the very deep-seated multi-agency anger about Pakistan that's really, at this point, it's become impossible to manage. You know, in previous years, like, Congress would be pissed off. The Vice President Cheney was furious for a while. Elements of CIA would be ticked off. Parts of DOD would be ticked off. But there would ultimately be this interagency decision to keep on kicking this can down the road. What we see now is that people are just not willing to do that. There is just a genuine sense, and I, quite frankly, I don't entirely support it. To simply write Pakistan off and disengage would be counterproductive. But that is where this interagency process is right now with Pakistan. Because you are actually on radio and you're subject to certain rules, I can't actually give you the direct quotations, but how my interlocutors describe our position vis-a-vis Pakistan typically involves a lot of verbs that are expletives.
So would this extend then to any kind of courtship of India in a military sense? I mean, the Pakistanis are paranoid about India's activity in Afghanistan. India has made some substantial investments in roads, etc. there. Their embassies have been attacked by the Haqqani network, obviously in league with the Pakistanis. Is there any is the U.S. talking to India about the post-2014 withdrawal of NATO from Afghanistan?
I mean, we've been talking to the Indians for years. We have a very robust strategic dialogue with the Indians that's inclusive of military dialogue. All of our services do exercises. We have a joint working group on counterterrorism and law enforcement. We routinely, we now have FBI legal attaches. I mean, the relationship that the U.S. and India enjoy, as I said, has been built up since 2000, i.e. before 2001. Obviously the Indo-US nuclear deal got a lot of press, but there were other deals on, for example, satellite launch technology. So our relationship with the Indians is driven by a sense that India and the U.S. have joint security concerns in the region, only one of which is Pakistan. I mean, the principal driver of our relationship with the Indians, quite frankly, is China, sea lanes of control, piracy, global commons. It is true that in the recent years, as the United States has come to view Pakistan differently, the U.S. and India have had a convergence on our understanding of the role that Pakistan plays in the region. But I also want to emphasize that if you look at the Indian government, there is a tremendous amount of discord about how they understand the Pakistani threat and how to deal with it. So I'm really pushing back on this idea that Panetta coming here and saying what he said represents something new in Indo-U.S. relations. It actually represents a continuation of a long-standing, slowly accumulating robustness in U.S.-Indian ties about security in the region. Now, speaking to the issue of Afghanistan in particular, since you raised it, the Indians themselves are having a pretty big debate about after 2014. The Indians, like the Chinese, they're essentially free riders under the U.S. security umbrella. So they're asking themselves, what are our strategic interests in Afghanistan? What kind of presence do we have to make to manage our objectives? And so the Indians themselves are having a fairly complicated discussion about what its options are and what their costs and benefits are. You know, on the one hand, you know, the U.S. has tended to see India's role in Afghanistan as uniformly positive. You know, I don't necessarily see it that way. But the fact of the matter is India is an extra-regional power. It has interests in the region. Pakistan is not an extra-regional power. It's an extra-regional nuisance. So, you know, from the U.S. point of view, do you continue to indulge Pakistan's paranoia? Do you continue to accept Pakistan's excuses for its behavior? Or do you simply let the regional dynamics play out on their own? And right now, I don't think this is not something that multiple, you know, the interagency process has really kind of figured out.
Well, Christine,
what is the ideal role of India in Afghanistan? I don't think there's an answer to that yet.
Well, Chris Fair, I thank you so much for joining us. We ran out of time, and I appreciate your staying up late in India to talk to us.
It's definitely my bedtime.
Yes, okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, and she's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Mexican presidential elections and the big debate tonight.